Distributing the Future broadcast November 20th, 2006, code 4 and by the people.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. We've got two pieces this week that originated with conversations that O'Reilly editor Chromatic recorded at this year's Foo Camp. In the first, he talks with Allison Randall and James Duncan about source code and how you can tell at least half the target audience are humans. He then talks about the Apache Software Foundation with Greg Stein. There's a joke that goes something like this. What do you call someone who speaks three languages? Trilingual. What do you call someone who speaks two languages? Bilingual. What do you call someone who speaks only one language? An American. In my case, it's embarrassingly true. So if source code was written in a language other than my own, how would I possibly understand it? O'Reilly technical evangelist Chromatic talks with Fotango's James Duncan and O'Reilly's Allison Randall about just that issue. He turns to James and says,
"When you write a computer program, a lot of people think you're writing it for the computer, but your argument is you're not, actually."
Yeah, absolutely. I think if I was writing it for a computer, I'd be writing in binary. I'd be writing ones and zeros, or sitting there with a switch and flipping the voltage up and down. But really, what you're doing is you're writing a language that's for other people. It's communicating of intent to other human beings.
Do you think it's fair to say that at some point we could create a large enough vocabulary for a particular domain that building a program is as easy as stringing together a few sentences?
Probably not, but it's a noble goal, if nothing else, right? I suppose you could if the problem domain is small enough, but then the tool that you're using is so specific that it's only ever going to be used in that problem domain, and that's not enough.
We understand things like construction of cabinets or tables or things like that well enough that we can put out books saying, here's how to build a cabinet if you've never done it before. Idly thinking, could we do that for software?
Well, I suppose people have tried with the design patterns, Gang of Four type stuff, but again, we're just not ready for that sort of level of industrialization yet. I've seen things go wrong with Gang of Four patterns where people just apply them on top of each other until it does what they want it to do, and that's a really bad idea, as it turns out. Given a sufficient number of design pattern implementations, any piece of software can do absolutely anything, but it doesn't do the right thing. And I just don't think in general we're ready for that yet. We've only been doing this for a couple of generations. We don't have that body of knowledge that's built up that lets us sort of just apply the sum of our knowledge to it. We're still working on the basis of individuals. I don't think Henry Ford sat down and said, right, it's time to industrialize car building. It was, it was just sort of the thing that happened. Economies work like that, I think. It's just someone will come along and figure out the way to do it, and everyone will slowly migrate to doing that. The problem is people are trying to come up with that. That's the question they're trying to answer, as opposed to just trying to solve individual problems and then seeing that big idea come along. The entire 90s was spent talking about object orientation and componentization just for the sake of being able to industrialize computing, and lots of what Java is coming up with one way to do it so that you can find anybody to do it, and the net result is anyone can write a pile of crap.
How do we reduce the cost of software or improve its maintainability then? What techniques do you think actually work now?
Employ people that are good at writing software. I don't think a certification is necessarily for most situations a good way of describing if someone is capable of doing something or not. That's sort of been taken up by the Java community simply to some extent because most people can approach that problem in that way, because that's the only way to approach the problem. And I think that you need to be able to ask someone, do you understand what's going on behind the scenes here, or are you simply just applying this rote idea of how to solve this problem? It's a craft. at the moment, and it's going to remain like that for a long time. Same as furniture making is a craft, but you can industrialize it because you know enough about the craft. Well, I'm just suggesting that we don't know enough about the craft to industrialize it.
There's also, I guess, a little bit of similarity in how you go about creating a novel to how you go about creating software. The processes you go through, trying to take a big picture and collapse it down to a written form. And actually the way you go through refactoring written text to refactoring code, there's a lot of similarity there too.
Do you see a difference between the primary purpose of a novel or the written word versus the primary purpose of a piece of source code?
Well, I suppose it depends on the novel. But
well, it's not like my novel, for example, is intended to calculate wind velocities when launching model rockets, for example.
No, probably true. I think that some writing is very close to source code in that you have a very specific effect that you expect that writing to have. Novels often don't fall in that category. Novels often fall more in the category of like writing software to create a random pattern on that slightly syncs with music or something like that. You're going for more of an inspirational effect than, well, at least the postmodern novel is going for more of an inspirational effect than it is the exact literal interpretation.
I really like that distinction because it seems like the point of the source code is to communicate. And we can throw out the functional effects if we look at just the artifacts of creation. I mean, the artifact of creating a software program is the source code. And you can generate other artifacts like the compiled binary or the deliverable builds from that. And the same thing sort of goes for creating a written work. The point is creating written words. You can look at a language. I mean, we call programming languages languages for various reasons. We apply linguistic techniques to them sometimes.
Well, there is a certain amount of similarity there in that once you have the written source code, you can translate it to various forms. And in some sense, half the purpose of source code is to translate it to machine language.
It's no different from spoken language, written language, art, as far as the painted picture or anything else. You're communicating the idea, and the sole purpose of it is to communicate that idea, be it software, be it written language, or whatever. And once that idea is communicated, the artifacts effectively are no good to you anymore. They're useless. Just like the book, people tend to read books once, and then they don't read them again because the idea has been passed on and will go off and do its own thing at that point. And it's a similar sort of thing.
So suppose I take a piece of source code I've written, and I've used English for my variable names, I've used English for my function names or whatever. I translate those into Urdu. How does that change the purpose of the text? How does that change the source code?
It changes it for half the audience, and that is the human half of the audience that has to read and maintain the software, and it makes it less readable, less maintainable. For the computer, it doesn't change it at all. The same meaning is conveyed.
Lots of what I do at Tango is trying to make things work a little bit better, and that's often, more often than not, the answer is a human answer rather than a software answer. A perfect example of this is the other day I was talking to someone about, and there's this one project we're doing where, and the nightly builds keep failing, and they keep failing because of different reasons every time. It's because people are basically writing a lot of software in a very quick period of time. And I was like, well, everyone needs to run the tests more often, right? And there it says, no, we want, if we automate it so that every 5 minutes it's smoked and then we can see when it fails more often. It's like, well, no, we already have effectively that. We just, as a culture, we need to run the tests more often, and if we do that, then we'll catch more nightly builds before they go wrong. And it's a human solution rather than a software, rather than a technical solution. It's just that's most of what we're doing is just coming up with a way of making that a little bit faster sometimes.
So you see the computer is a sort of a crutch. The computer can take care of this for us, the computer can worry about this for us, but if you put that back and make it a barrier for people, they have the opportunity to solve their own problems in a personal way. It's a people problem they're trying to solve in a people way.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say like the most successful tool ever is Excel, right? And the reason why Excel is so loved is because it allows effectively non-technical people to solve very, very complicated technical problems and that are to do with their domain. And it's one of the reasons why people have a computer on every desktop is so that execs can play with Excel all day and see what happens if they make a percentage point more sales in this region or whatever. It's a tool for expressing how things go wrong or how things can change each other. It lets non-technical people do very technical things, but you could solve that same problem with a piece of paper. It's just a hell of a lot harder.
But you could also say, solve the same problem a lot better with Excel, learning to use it better, but people don't.
Well, yeah, but that's because they don't need to. It's good enough.
So good enough software. Is that what you're looking for?
No, I'm looking for good enough tools for people. Excel, for example, is a good enough tool for most business people to express a more or less valid model of their business so that they can plot what's going to happen in the future. You can't consider Excel any more of a piece of software than you can a compiler. It happens to be a piece of software, but the point and the purpose is to understand what your business is doing, not necessarily to write an Excel macro or whatever.
So you want to solve problems, and if you have to do that with software, that's fine. But if you don't have to use software, that's fine too.
Yeah, absolutely. The software is just, it's there as an aid. But yeah, if you don't have to use a computer, then good luck. I'd far rather see problems solved without them than with them.
You've got to love a geek who prefers not to use a computer when he doesn't have to. James Duncan and Allison Randall talking with Chromatic. Chromatic also sat down with Greg Stein and talked to him about the Apache Software Foundation and the community surrounding the code. In fact, that's where Stein begins as he explains that
the idea behind Apache is really about the community taking care of the code in the long term. Rather than concentrating on the people that are contributing to the project, we want to concentrate on the community. And from that, the code just naturally falls out. But one of the things that we've started thinking about is how can we really sort of export what we've learned. Apache is really there to produce code, to give code to the world. We're a charitable foundation. But I think we can also achieve that same mission by enabling others to produce code, others to be able to make stuff that's 10, 20 years old and can continue for that kind of duration. You know, how do we run a community? What are the key things about the health of a community? Peer respect and how people vote and get things done, consensus-based development, those kinds of things lots of communities can use to make themselves much more effective, to make them healthy in the long term so that they can take a code base, and as the committers come and go, that code base can continue. The Apache web server is a great example of this, where the original eight people who established the Apache web server, they aren't really contributing to the code base anymore. It's a whole different group. It's generally like four people are actively contributing at any time, and that four has changed over the past dozen years. If somebody comes to Apache and says, well, you know, forget the governance, I just want a repository and maybe a mailing list, but really I just want a place for my code, that doesn't fit in with what we want at Apache. We want communities and communities that will eventually produce the code. There are a lot of project hosting sites out there where people can go ahead, sign up, get the repository space. Apache doesn't really want to be in there. We want the communities. You know, you take a look at the Apache web server, and it's now, I think the first release was March 95, and it's still going strong. It's the number one web server, and it's been number one for something like 10 years. How do you produce code that can survive for 10 years? And how do you write code that can survive for 20 years, 30 years? And part of that is about, you know, having the community. Now, the assumption is, well, do you need code to survive that long? And when you look at most of the things that we use, a lot of that stuff was built a long time ago. So the answer generally is, yeah, you need stuff that will last. There's a lot of, you know, little helpful tools that, you know, kind of come and go. But the basic infrastructural stuff that we use on a day-to-day basis are all very, very old pieces of software. Even, you know, when you look at something like Mozilla, they say, well, we're going to do a ground-up rewrite. And they did, but there's huge sections in there that you just can't rewrite everything. And in many cases, there's no need to rewrite everything. So you have code that sticks around. You look at something like SendMail or Bind. Those have been around for 20, 30 years. I don't know exactly how long they've been, but a long, long time. SendMail and Bind are fortunate in that they both have companies behind them, and the companies are establishing the kind of longevity. But, you know, with Apache, we really want, you know, open source. We want communities to do that because companies come and go. They lose interest. You know, we just mentioned Mozilla. Well, you know, Netscape, it's no longer present. So what do you do with that code base? Mozilla Foundation has picked it up, but there might not always be a Mozilla Foundation. There might not be an Apache Software Foundation. There might not be a foundation there to pick it up, is what I mean, when a company disappears. And so having it at one of these foundations and enabling it for that long term is really what we want to do. One of the things that we've been doing at Apache right now is trying to figure out sort of a sponsorship program, something that'll give us the funds so that we can guarantee that we're going to really survive for the next 50 years. And I think it's an interesting perspective when you get a whole bunch of hackers together, and there's something like 1,200, 1,300 committers at Apache, and throw the question at them that says, okay, what do we need to do to keep this around for 50 years? And most people, they're just thinking about the code. But some people, you know, myself and some of the other members of the ASF, we're also thinking about how do you keep the organization itself around for that long to take care of that code that all those committers are writing. The ASF sort of applies a little corrective pressure to communities to ensure that we're all sort of aware of ourselves, you know, that every now and then we need to do a little navel gazing and go, okay, are we actually, you know, do we have all the metrics of peer respect? Do we have the metrics of proper consensus-based development? And that's not always the case at Apache. And sometimes, you know, we have to provide a little corrective action. We have to tell the projects, you know, stop doing whatever it is and, you know, talk more on the mailing list. We need more, you know, open public discourse. The size of the foundation certainly helps. We've been able to effect changes in other companies, some of the standardization processes. I wouldn't say we've changed anything with the European patent stuff that was happening last year, but we had some people involved in that to try and educate people about the effect of patents on open source code. Moving forward, I think we're going to continue to have that. You know, some companies are trying to establish certain standards that may be patent encumbered. And when we find that, you know, we kind of sit up and we take a stand. We say, you know, don't do that. That's a bad standard. And some of this happened a few years ago around some anti-spam stuff. And we were able to write an open letter, and that had some actual change. Unfortunately, it shut down the standardization process, you know, but it was, in my mind, better than having a standard that could be submarined by a patent. It was also the way things were going. Users of the anti-spam stuff would have to register with a company. And users shouldn't have to do that. You know, a company has no right to know who's using the software. Anybody should be able to use it. And so that was one of the big things that we had against it. You know, we've worked on opening up certain standardization processes. So I think our size can be beneficial in that respect. But at the same time, some people are also starting to call us the 800-pound gorilla of the open software world. Yeah. You know, that's also kind of true. And I think that we have to continue to watch out for how we use our size. You know, we have the power to use it for good or evil. So, yeah, for a while I thought, you know, there probably is a certain type of project that we have sort of a natural tendency towards certain projects. And I figured, we'll never have a database. Right. Well, we've got Apache Derby. So, you know, I've kind of given up on the idea that there's one type of project, that there's things that fit or don't fit. And I think, you know, certainly we don't have like any real desktop software. We don't have basic, you know, like kernel utilities or some of the basic infrastructure for operating system distributions. Over time, yeah, you know, I could see something, you know, a tool like the BusyBox or something like that being an Apache project, or, you know, some pieces of, you know, GNOME or KDE where people want a different governance model than what's going on with those projects. It's entirely possible, and I think over time that will happen. I have no idea what kind of stuff is going to arrive first, but I think we will. One of the other questions that has come up is there a size limit? Do we have any kind of limits to how large we can grow? And right now, one of the biggest bottlenecks has been the legal oversight that the board needs to exert. And the board actually reviews reports from all the different projects. And so every month, the board meets and we review project reports. It's a big part of what we do. And as the number of projects grew, we were spending more and more and more time. And so about this time last year, we were spending about an hour and a half of our two-hour meeting just reviewing project reports. But we've gone through a couple changes, and now we reviewed twice as many reports as we did last year in about 25 minutes. So through continued changes in our process, I think we can continue to provide the oversight and continue to scale up to more and more projects that can live under that legal umbrella. I think, you know, the notion of a number of foundations is good, but recently I've come to think that we already have enough, that creating more and more foundations is not the right answer, that they continue to compartmentalize communities, but more importantly, they take a lot of time away. There's been some work to set up a foundation for Subversion, and right from the start, I was like, don't do it. Please don't do it. It's going to take a lot of time, and I watched a couple of the people literally spend months and months of effort on it, and much of it really hasn't helped. I mean, they're still working on it. There's still more effort to be done. And even once it does finally get established, after all this effort, somebody still has to run the board meetings. Somebody still has to, you know, take the secretarial notes. Somebody still has to file IRS tax forms. And that means that there's somebody that's not writing code. There's somebody that's not contributing to what we're really trying to accomplish, and that's produce more open source code. And so I think where we've got people doing it already, take advantage of that with the GNOME Foundation, with the Perl Foundation, Apache Foundation. Take advantage of those people. Don't try and create your own. It's just going to suck a lot of time away from what you really want to accomplish. One of the things that I've really learned at Apache is the notion of community and what that really means. And when I talk to so many different people in the open source community at large, that notion of community, you find it everywhere. You know, whether it's the whole gang of people developing Perl, all the Python developers, people working in Subversion, the different communities in Apache, and the larger overall Apache as a whole community. It creates a lot of worldwide friendships. You know, I'm going to Europe next month, and I'm going to go visit and stay with some friends. How did I meet them? Through the open source world. I was in Japan a couple months ago, and somebody asked, you know, well, what should a engineer in Japan do? And my first point was get involved with open source. You know, it can help you from a career standpoint in terms of, you know, people can see what you're doing. They can see how well you interact with others. It establishes new relationships with peers, new people around the world. And so the notion of community is great. You know, sitting here talking to you, you know, how did I meet you? Well, it was through this open source community. And so that's one of the things that I really like about this and why I continue to be so involved in open source is really getting to know so many different people doing so many different things and the huge amount of creativity, but also just the huge variety of people that I get to meet and get to you know, really be friends with around the world.
Thanks to Greg Stein, Chromatic, Allison Randall, and James Duncan. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Patino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at Batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.